sort of thing. We just thought that it wasn't fair for someone who was trying to get their life back together to accidentally check the wrong box and effectively be thrown back in prison because of a felony violation.
Section 3 and 7 provide the Secretary of State with additional data. As you know, the data that is available through the Corrections Department and the courts is privileged and not entirely accessible by the Secretary of State. This bill allows some of that data to be brought forward so the Secretary of State can use last known addresses and that sort of thing. I believe the bill specifically provides that it may only be used as explicitly authorized, and it is still private information. Section 4 removes the responsibility for investigating voting violations from the county attorneys to the law enforcement agencies. I certainly haven't done a complete study of all Minnesota statutes, but as I understand, this is the only statute that requires a prosecutor to investigate and prosecute. Requires part of the problem what we found is that there isn't a coordinated effort, whether it's in the court system or the probation system or the corrections department, to identify exactly when your civil rights are
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, as Beth Fraser read the federal law, it's very general. So certainly this seems to me that it would fall under that general parameter. But, of course, this wasn't specifically listed in the federal law. So I guess I would leave that up to your determination on how you would like to interpret the broadness.
Madam Chair, if
Senator Limmer.
If it was going to be left up to me, as counsel suggests, I would say it's not accurate. It's not part of the HAVA Act of 2002. And someone in the future could be reading this. If this passes into law, they might assume that it is. And I think specificity is important as we write this law.
Ms. Fraser, if I understood you correctly, so if we took out the on lines 2.20 and 2.21, if we took out the as required by the Help America Vote Act of 2000. Adopted. Are there any other questions at this time, or I believe we have Senator Limmer?
If I could bring our committee's attention to page 4, lines 22 to 23. This was a question that came up in the Judiciary Committee as well. As you can tell, we're scratching off a lot of existing law in the 201.275 section on investigations and prosecution, and taking all of that out and then making a reference to a second edition of the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association. I raised the question, what does that mean in Judiciary Committee? And I think they thought that I was placated by the we know what we're voting on.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, the person or the county attorney's office, the County Attorneys Association, is the body who asked us to change that reference from the American Bar Association to this particular reference because that was the better, for lack of a better word, source to use as a guide. I don't see a representative from the County Attorney's Office or County Attorney Association with us. So again, I can't be any more specific than that. And I think, in fact, I know that when he asked for that amendment to occur in the Judiciary Committee, that I thought he answered your question along with the line of questioning that I believe that you are beginning to go down now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Champion, whether it's the Bar Association or whether it's this reference from the National District Attorneys Association, that's the new standard you want us to accept. I don't know what's in that new standard. We're taking all of the rest of the old law out and wanting to agree to this standard that's referenced here, and I want to know what it means. And as the chief author, I would think that now that we're in the second line of questioning, we're probing this area of the statute.
Senator Limmer, it was my understanding that all of your questions were answered in the Judiciary Committee. And that's when we had the testifier here who could embellish as well as provide insight as to why the county attorneys preferred to use the source that's articulated in the engrossed bill. As a person who is not a county attorney, but one who is a learned person in the law, I understand that there are certain standards that we all will use and try to adhere to in order to give us guidance when it comes to performing our duties. And we will try to get someone else here for you from the County Attorneys Association to be able to answer your question specifically about the National Prosecution Standards published by the National District Attorneys Association.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
And Senator Champion, I was not satisfied with the question or the answer to the question in Judiciary Committee. I think you might recall that I reminded you that I sit on the Elections Committee and that I would be asking this question. And so just to keep the record straight, I'm still in the dark as what this means.
Senator,
I don't know what the standards are.
Senator Limmer, we cannot. Council is going to check to try to get that information. And so, and I believe we're working on getting it. So if we could, if you would indulge us and let us move on from this point and then we'll get back to it. That's okay.
And Madam Chair, just for the committee's information, a representative from the County Attorneys Association is on their way over in order to further answer any other questions that Senator Limmer or other committee members may have about this reference.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? Otherwise, we do have two people who have signed up to testify on the bill. The first is Jeff Narabrook. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Narabrook with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide association of about 2,000 organizations. We're also members of the Voting Rights Coalition. That's a group working on encouraging voter participation and strengthening our election laws. Under the status quo of our current laws, we see Senate File 164 as a much-needed change. You know, nonprofits have a unique perspective on this issue. Many organizations are the ones who are assisting former offenders in reintegration, rehabilitation, providing mental health, housing, job support, education, things like that. And during every election cycle, I inevitably get calls from nonprofit staff members who are doing voter registration with clients and aren't sure how to handle citizens who've had a felony conviction. And on the one hand, the staff member doesn't want to be the person that's going to get that person in trouble by encouraging them to register to vote when they're not allowed to. On the other, they don't want to discourage participation if the rights have been restored. So, and as we heard before, sometimes even a call to the parole officer, which is what we recommend, doesn't always clarify it. So all that to say, it's clear that I think much work does remain to be done to explain the current law, to those who are affected, and that this bill does take important steps in that direction. But as you take up this bill, I also encourage you to maybe take a pause and broaden the conversation to include the so-called North Dakota model. That's a model used by 13 other states. It's a simple policy. If you've had a criminal conviction, unless you're currently incarcerated, you can vote. As you know, the Governor's Election Integrity Task Force did extensive research into it. They did recommend that the legislature examine it along with other policies such as the bill before you. In their report, they noted some of the following benefits. It disenfranchises fewer citizens. It's more easily understood by all. That could be election administrators or people directly affected by it. It eliminates some of the administrative and prosecutorial oversight that we're discussing here. It avoids the cost of implementing new data notification systems. Unless your crime was election fraud, I don't think it makes good sense as a retributive punishment to restrict your voting rights. There's no real link between whatever you did that was wrong and trying to right that wrong and restricting your voting right. I also don't think there's really any reason to see it as an effective deterrent to dissuade others from committing crimes. You know, there are many other serious penalties that come with felony convictions, and I don't think that taking away your right to vote is going to deter people from committing crimes. So I do think there probably is a reason for this law, and it may be the belief that the state has an interest in reserving voting for only those who've kept a social contract, that it erodes confidence in our elections when people who have shown disregard for laws, you know, are given equal say as those who have abided by them. And I understand that sentiment, but ultimately I do think it's problematic. For one, it doesn't consider the possibility of self-transformation or reform. Remember, parole and probation can last for many years after crime has been committed. So I don't think it makes sense to say, you know, you did something bad in your past, so we're going to assume you continue to have no regard for our laws even long after maybe you've served time in prison.
Mr. Narrowbrook?
Yes.
I certainly appreciate hearing your opinions on the North Dakota model, but if you could please try, just because we have a long agenda, to keep your comments to the bill before us.
You bet. In that case, Madam Chair, I'll end my testimony. I think it's a mistake to move forward on this bill without at least having a discussion of this other option. There's many other community organizations who agree. They'd love to come here and tell you so themselves. So I just encourage you, before advancing this bill, which does some great things, to also consider all the options out there.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Next on the agenda is Dan McGrath. Mr. McGrath, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan McGrath, president of Minnesota Majority. I think the basic intent of Senate File 164 is good and useful. Better notification to convicted felons of their voting status may reduce the chance of our elections being corrupted by errors, mistakes by voters that just didn't understand the law. That said, I have some concerns about specific sections of the bill, and I hope the committee will consider some changes before moving the bill along. I've noticed that this committee so far has had some pretty substantive election bills heard that have been laid over, which I think is good. Our election system is very complex. It comprises 13 chapters of statute, and a piecemeal approach to amending the statutes I think would be inadvisable. Instead, it's important that we look at the system as a whole. Tugging on one thread in one statute can unravel other areas of our election law and system in undesirable ways. But to the bill at hand, I want to refer you to Section 3, which has the apparent intent to reduce the offense of intentionally registering a person who is not eligible from a felony to a misdemeanor. There is no need to reduce the penalties for mistakenly registering to vote when not eligible, because there is currently no penalty for mistakenly registering to vote. The law requires intent in order to get a conviction. Likewise, no one can commit accidental voter fraud. The standard for conviction is ineligible voter knowingly votes. After the 2008 election, Minnesota's majority's research uncovered over 1,000 ineligible felons who had registered and voted. 200 were later convicted for ineligible voter knowingly votes, but most of them were never charged, largely because intent to vote while ineligible couldn't be proven. Under existing statutes, only people who knowingly register or vote while ineligible are actually guilty of a crime. It's important to keep in mind that this section of the bill, Section 3, doesn't just affect felons. It will also impact people who are not mentally competent, people who may try to take advantage of those people for purposes of voter fraud. I think if you're deliberately registering someone who is, for example, mentally incapacitated for nefarious fraudulent reasons, that should be a felony. But the way this section is written, it would reduce that crime to a misdemeanor because the section of the bill it's tampering with doesn't just deal with the actions of a voter, but anyone who intentionally causes or attempts to cause an ineligible voter to be registered. Because intent is required for a crime to be present, Section 3, as written, does not accomplish what I believe the authors intended to, and it should be probably stricken from the bill. Amending the section to comport the apparent intent would serve no real purpose because it's not a crime to accidentally register when you're not eligible. We're moving on to Section 5. This one's particularly concerning for me and our organization. Section 5 takes the responsibility to investigate and charge voter fraud away from the county attorney, and this has really, really big ramifications. This will ultimately make investigating and prosecuting voter fraud optional. With no one person responsible, there's no one to be held to account. Right now, it's a crime for a county attorney not to take action on fraud. And from my experiences, I believe it's the only reason many of the cases charged in the past several years were ever charged, resulting in 200 recent convictions for voter fraud. This radical change could lead to politically motivated selective prosecution of voter fraud. It will assuredly lead to lax and inconsistent enforcement, and the public or individuals lodging voter fraud complaints will have no recourse. Because failing to faithfully investigate and prosecute voter fraud has political ramifications that can affect the outcome of elections and shake voter confidence in the system, it should remain a crime. The buck has to stop somewhere. Some identifiable official must be responsible for investigating fraud complaints, and there must be a mechanism to hold that individual accountable if, for political or other reasons, they fail to uphold the law. I realize that this is very different than how investigation and prosecution is handled for other crimes in this state, but voter fraud is an entirely different kind of crime. The legislature had good reason to put this on the county attorney. I think it's very dangerous to remove that safeguard. Section 5, bill, it's not even related to the bill's intent of notifying felons on the status of their voting rights. Section 7, has the intent of making prosecution of ineligible voters easier, but I'm not sure it's sufficient as written to accomplish that objective. Besides proving that an ineligible person voted, in order to get a conviction, you also have to prove that they knew that they were ineligible to vote. The top of the voter roster contains an oath. Part of that is certifying that the voter isn't under supervision for felony and that they're 18 and they're a citizen, etc. A signature as evidence should be evidence not only that they intended to vote, but they read and affirmed the oath if this section is going to have any actual effect. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm happy to stay and answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. McGrath.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 164? The committee page did obtain a copy from Ms. Stengel of the county attorney or the whatever it's called, that the National Prosecution Standards, and is making copies for all committee members. So, Senator Champion, if it's okay, perhaps we'll set your bill aside at. The county attorney person is not here yet either, are they? So perhaps we could just set this bill aside for a few minutes until we get those copies passed out and the witness comes, and then we'll take your bill back up. So we'll just lay over Senate File 164 at this time. and then move on to Senator Eakin's Senate File 464. Well, Senator Eakin is going to the table to, if members would look at the minutes that were passed out, Senator Ress moves the minutes from Wednesday, February 20th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Senator Limmer.
I wanted to thank you for advancing minutes to members of the committee prior to asking for their approval. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Well, it's really thanks goes to Janice. Senator Eakin, Senate File 464.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And and I'd like to move this to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I also have an amendment, an author's amendment. This is the first committee to be heard in, and just want to get it in the shape and form that I would like, and it's just a purely technical amendment. So
Senator Eakin,
I would like
moves
to move the A2 amendment.
All those in favor, please say aye. 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 Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Aye. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill, it really doesn't change current state law at all in regard to presidential elections, but it does encourage other states to follow a model which has now been looked upon by other states in regard to electoral votes and electors specifically. In 2004, one of the Minnesota presidential electors voted for John Edwards for president instead of for John Kerry. This raised the concern about unfaithful electors. Now, in that election, it didn't have any impact. It didn't change the outcome at all. But there was concern that it possibly could. It had the potential to. And so after this occurred, the Minnesota legislature passed an act that effectively assured that our electors cast votes that were consistent with the Minnesota popular vote. In 2008, the Uniform Laws Commission started drafting a uniform act to assure that electors in other states would be prevented from casting improper votes. The Uniform Laws Commission found the Minnesota law well done, and they based its draft uniform act on our law here in Minnesota. Now, what we're proposing here is to pass the Uniform Act. And you may wonder why, since we already have it in place here. Well, the purpose of it is to really encourage other states to do the same thing. It does help to pass a Uniform Act in other states if we and a number of other states have already passed that same Uniform Act. So, and that's because states view each enacting state as evidence that the act makes sense. The more enacting states there are, the easier it is to persuade a legislature to pass the Uniform Act in other states. And Minnesota does have an interest in having electors in other states vote correctly as well. Obviously, if we address the issue but other states don't, there's still incentive for mischief to occur in those other states and for the election to be affected by unfaithful electors. So this is all designed, again, to encourage other states to follow suit. So this bill just substitutes the Uniform Act, which is based on our law, for the Minnesota law upon which it is based. The whole purpose of this bill, again, it's to encourage other states to follow our lead. And the act addresses a problem that in practice it may only rarely arise, but it has the potential to inflict great harm to our electoral process. Uniform adoption of the act will assure that the solution is consistent among the states. It will foreclose attempts to peel off electors and help states to secure their full complements of electoral votes. And so with that, I'll open it up to any questions that you may have on the bill.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I happened to have been the Secretary of State when that ballot was opened. And it was quite a shock to have to read off a name knowing what this meant to people much less how to handle it. So I'm interested in this in regards to it helping. But one thing I want to caution you, I have gone through the first series of changing of the law and then now this second one. And sometimes, just so you know, the unpredictable consequences of things that happen. So portraying this as this should be the final solution, been there before, and it seemed good, and it wasn't necessarily the case, though I appreciate the effort to make it as clear as you can. But even in reading of this, some of these things that I see here, I remember we had a snowstorm one time, and an elector couldn't get in. And we had to go through some significant issues, but to let you know, we worked it out with the governor's office and got it accomplished. And it was, by the way, the one who lived closest, not the one from way up north, which I thought was interesting, as we find sometimes the one from farther away gets there first.
Right. Well, we have snowmobiles up north, yes. Madam Chair, so that's... Yeah.
And you're kind of used to having to figure things out. I knew you might appreciate that. So just so you know, and especially when you add more definitive things, it doesn't mean that something can't happen yet.
Senator Egan?
Yes, and Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I certainly understand that. I mean, obviously, I'm not suggesting that this is the final solution, but it certainly is stepping in the right direction, and I think it's important to encourage other states to step in that same direction of trying to address the potential pitfalls of having unfaithful electors. And again, it's not likely to occur in any particular election, but if there is a close election where it's decided by one or two electoral votes, there is great potential for mischief to be done because the incentive will be great to try to peel off electors and lead to these unfaithful electors. So again, I don't suggest that it's the final solution, but certainly moving in the right direction.
And, Senator Eakin, just to build on it, it looks like in Section 7, by designating an alternate elector nominee, that could address some of the concerns that you raised, Senator Kiffmeyer, about an elector possibly not being able to be there. There would be an alternate designated.
Oh, Madam Chair, there was an alternate present.
Oh.
And so there is that already in current law. So we did provide for that, it really was, it's a very great privilege to be an elector, and as you would know, no sooner did we seat the other person than the original elector came in. It was very upset that they had been superseded, especially when you had a snowstorm, and it was quite a meeting involving the governor's general counsel, both political parties, all kinds of things going on, plus the individual members who are electors or alternates. And once again, you know, in Minnesota, we predictably go this direction. So we managed to go through, but we had two situations already, and one, both times involved general counsel, but we did get it done. So the fact that you have alternates, I look at this and say, yeah, we had that before. And it did not necessarily work out that way, and it wasn't so smooth as you would think. Timing was an issue.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, you had made the comment that we should support or pass this bill because it will help other states pass the Uniform Act. And I will tell you that I am candidly not a great fan of uniform acts. And insofar as election law and our electors, it is one area where the state of Minnesota or the various states do have the ability to control and determine how their electors should vote in a presidential election. So, you know, I would just ask that you talk a little bit more and educate me a little bit more about the difference between Minnesota law as it currently stands and the uniform law. In other words, are we currently have in place a law that conforms to the Uniform Act and we are simply, in effect, simply retitling our statutes, or are we changing something that is a lot more substantive in order to adopt and conform to the Uniform Act?
And Madam Chair and Senator Newman, it basically complies with what we already have, although there is a little more to it. It does, for instance, there is more, I believe, on the alternate, whereas we didn't have as much pertaining to that, so it actually tightens it up a little more and explains the process a little more thoroughly, including the alternate process. So it's basically nothing new from what we have. It may add to it a little bit, and Ms. Frazier is here to explain the details of some of that. But it's basically, again, it doesn't make any changes to the current law that we have now. It's actually based on the current law that we have now. Adds a little bit to it to clarify and to expand on, just to make sure that for instance, the issues that Senator Kiffmeyer was talking about are being addressed about the alternate process. So,
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Eakin. Are you saying then that the adoption of this bill is being made because it's good for the state of Minnesota, or are you saying that adoption of this bill is going to be good because it will help support the passage of the uniform law in other states?
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I would say both. It's good for our state, and it's good for, you know, in trying to encourage other states to follow suit. It's good for our whole country to make sure that we address this issue of unfaithful electors and prevent mischief from occurring should there be a close presidential election in the future. Again, it's not likely to occur, but we've had closer elections in recent years than we have, for some time. I think there's a great potential for it happening sometime in the near future if we don't address it now. And again, it's in our interest as a state to make sure that other states also are addressing the issue so that the candidate who wins is the one that the majority of the people want. I think we need to protect the will of the people here, and that's what's being done. And every state has a vested interest in doing that, including Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, given your answer, could you then go through the bill and point out for me the difference between the uniform law and the law as currently stands in Minnesota?
And Madam Chair and Senator Newman, Ms. Frazier does have some of the more detailed information on the differences. So.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State. Senator Newman, there are two differences of note, I believe, between the current law and the proposed uniform law. And one is that although Minnesota currently has 10 electors, current law currently requires that we have 8 alternates. And so there's not a one-to-one match between the number of electors and the number of alternates currently. This would require a one-to-one match, and I believe it requires that each elector be paired with an alternate. Right now, I believe if an elector were not able to serve, that there's a process for choosing which of the alternates should fill that elector's place because there's not a one-to-one match. Whereas under the bill, there is a designated alternate for each elector. So if a specific elector is not able to perform the duties, a specific alternate would fulfill those duties. The other difference is on page 2. Starting with the stricken language starting on 2.19, there's currently a requirement that electors show up at 9 a.m. and meet at 9 a.m. on the day of the Electoral College. And this deletes the requirement for that meeting. They are, as you see on, in the lines above that, starting on 2.15, required to be present the day before at the Capitol at noon. So they're required to come on Monday at noon to say we're here. The current law also requires them to come at 9 a.m. on the day of, and then they officially meet at noon. So this says they need to come on Monday at noon and then again on Tuesday at noon. I'm sorry, it's Sunday and Monday, but the day before and the day of. I believe that those are the two most major changes between current law and the proposed bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Just a quick question for Ms. Fraser. Ms. Fraser, we don't usually talk of electors too much. Happens once every 4 years. Do we provide them a per diem or a reimbursement for costs for the job that they do?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, yes, they are entitled to a per diem.
All right.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in Senate File 464? Seeing no one, Senator Egan moves that Senate File 464 be laid over as amended for inclusion in the elections omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. We will go back now at this time to Senate File 164. Senator Champion, it's my understanding that John Kingry from the County Attorneys Association is here, and also the page has made copies of the standards that were in question. If you could, thank you, please distribute those. Mr. Kingry, if you wanted to perhaps begin explaining them or why these standards are the ones that are preferred in this bill.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingry, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And what you have before you are probably, I guess, about eight pages that I had PDF'd and sent to Senate Council last week to explain some of the aspects of the national prosecution standards put together by the National District Attorneys Association. This bill is almost identical to the bill that was introduced last year in both the House and the Senate, and was making some progress in the House. And like a lot of other well-intended bills, there wasn't sufficient money to fund it, and so it sort of stopped there. And we were prepared to offer this amendment last year. The House author, I don't recall who it was right now, was willing to Benson, Representative Benson, was willing to accept that amendment. And basically, it's our view that the standards by the National District Attorneys Association are more appropriate for prosecutors than the American Bar Association standards. I did look up the ABA standards, and they're about a page and a half. They give you sort of the highlights, the things to do and not do, and the things to follow. The National District Attorneys Association standards gets, if you will, more down in the weeds in terms of how you should conduct your office, how you should prosecute cases, for example, establishing written guidelines and so forth. And so it's simply more specific and more tailored for prosecution, and that's why we thought it was the better standard rather than the American Bar Association.
Mr. Kingry, could you just explain how, in adopting the national prosecution standards by the Attorneys Association, the District Attorneys Association, why that's, in your opinion, better than the current statute, that the current law that's in state statute?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we supported the work of the governor's task force in this area. I think if we were to divert in one area, it might be this area. We believe that Minnesota Statutes 201.275 should simply be repealed. That is the only statute that I'm aware of that directs prosecutors to investigate a case and upon probable cause to prosecute. Whether it's murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, I'm not aware of one other statute that requires this. And because of this, failure to do this results in the forfeiture of the county attorney's office. And so our folks are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars prosecuting these cases, running these individuals down. And quite frankly, with limited resources, we'd rather focus our energies more on public safety risks. And so our first preference would be to repeal that. I know this is an interim step, and therefore we support the current version before you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Kingry. What I heard you say here is that instead of prosecuting these, you'd rather use your time and resources for something else that you deem more important. It gives me the impression then that if law enforcement agencies were given this duty, I think it addresses the very question. Would these cases be presented to you at all? And would they be prosecuted? I mean, the impression I get from your comments is concerning.
Mr. Kingrey?
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, that is not an accurate description of my comments. We're presented with a number of reports from law enforcement all the time. And like everything else, we've got to prioritize. Are we going to deal with a very, very minor misdemeanor or petty misdemeanor, or are we going to deal with a more serious felony? If when law enforcement does bring to us allegations of a violation, we take them very seriously, and I would expect anything that's presented to us to be reviewed and, if appropriate, then prosecuted.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I would support this because I think that the testifier's testimony is compelling that this is the only place in the statute that requires them to move forward. I think that we've given our county attorneys, and rightfully so, some discretion in taking a look at what has been presented to them and then make a decision based on their best judgment. And we most certainly support them in every other opportunity, their best judgment, to move forward if this is something that they think is a problem or not a problem significant enough to push forward. And so it would seem to me that we would want to continue to give them that discretion and that opportunity to make those decisions, as we trust that they do each and every day when they're presented with crimes all the way from taking someone's life to voter fraud or shoplifting or whatever they have to deal with. And I think it would be important for us to continue to give them that discretion, Madam Chair and Senator Champion. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I don't know if we all know when the original language was put into our law books. I might guess that maybe the reason why it's the only reference for direct prosecution action is based on the serious nature and how we consider the role of voting is to our way of governing, and that it might be the only reference for a specific reason that we wanted to emphasize that it was very close. In recent history, we've noticed that the elections seem to be getting closer and closer on statewide races. It kind of gives an indication that the state may be slowly, finally getting to a point where it's a definite two-party system. And, of course, you've got your other third and fourth parties that are floating around, too. But if we're entering a time when it's becoming more and more a parity between voters, that there's a very close range, then any single violation of voting becomes very instrumental and very key to the outcome. And I would tend to think that, at least for now, with the makeup of the state the way it votes now, with very close statewide races, that we would want to keep this language.
Senator Limmer, I don't know if Mr. Kingrey can attest to this more, but I recall in some of the task force hearings, hearing from county attorneys who felt like they were being presented with evidence that was less than conclusive, but because of the nature of this statute, felt compelled to investigate and spend thousands of dollars on that investigation, even when they knew it was not the best use of taxpayers' money, or perhaps there was an explanation that they could that they could come up with fairly easily in terms of why they shouldn't move forward. But because of this statute, we're forced to move forward. I think if you look carefully at the new language that's being proposed, it says if there's probable cause for instituting a prosecution, the county attorney shall proceed in accordance with these national prosecution standards. So as Mr. Kingrey said, although it's their preference to strike this entire section of statute from the law, the task force thought that this was a prudent use of taxpayers' money while also ensuring the public that there's when there is substantial evidence that is presented to the law enforcement that that prosecution can still take place. Mr. Kingrey, is that fairly accurate?
Madam Chairman, yes, that's how I would describe it. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer already alluded to my first question, and so I will be able to skip over that. But, you know, I find this section that is being proposed to be deleted, I don't know if I'd agree with Senator Hayden that it is compelling, but it really is interesting. I mean, it is a very unusual clause to have in our law to give that kind of direction to our elected officials who are the county attorneys. So I do find it really interesting, and I'm really curious as to what the legislative history would be as to why we have this in our law. Now, Senator Limmer has been here for a long time, and he isn't aware of it. So, you know, maybe we could find out why we have this very unusual clause in our statutes. The other question then, but that I would have for Mr. Kingrey is this: we are making reference under this proposal to some national prosecutorial standards, which you have been kind enough to give us copies of, but frankly, I have not yet read. My question would be: is with respect to the prosecution of other crimes, other felonies, gross misdemeanors, et cetera, do our statutes prescribe similar guidance that you are to proceed in accordance with these national prosecutional standards, or is this unique in terms of election law violations?
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Newman, again, this is the only statute that directs there must be an investigation and there must be a prosecution, otherwise the office is forfeited. The other statutes, it describes the offense, it describes what the recommended sentence might be, and then we have to prove our case before a jury. The law enforcement does the investigation, they present it to us, and then we proceed if there is probable cause. If we don't believe we've been given probable cause, we can't move forward or violate our code of conduct, our ethics standard. With regard to the history of this, I am going to contact former Anoka County Attorney Bob Johnson. I've got a feeling he was around back in those days. And let me see. I'll try to find out what his version of where this came from.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kingrey, perhaps you didn't understand my question, so I'm going to take another shot at it. If we adopt the proposal contained in Section 5, county attorney is no longer going to be mandated or required to prosecute. So that issue is going to be gone. But we make reference then in the proposed bill that you are to proceed in accordance with these national prosecution standards. My question is this unique to election criminal violations to proceed in accordance with the national prosecution standards? Or are you, not you personally, but county attorneys, required in terms of other criminal violations to prosecute in accordance with those standards?
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Newman, no, we are not required to proceed with these standards in any other criminal violations. The reason, and I thank Senator Champion for advocating and bringing forth this amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee, the reason we came forward with this standard is because we did not believe the ABA standard, which was in here previously, was the appropriate standard for prosecutors. And so the thinking was, if you're going to have a standard, that the National District Attorneys Association standard would be the most appropriate. Again, our preference is it be deleted, but I know that's not on the table, so I won't push that again.
Senator Newman.
Thank you for your patience, Madam Chair. Mr. Kingrey, whether we're dealing with national prosecution standards or ABA standards, is this unique to election criminal violations to require the county attorneys to proceed in accordance with a standard as compared to other criminal offenses?
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Newman, I guess I would say this, it is appropriate. I'm not sure exactly.
Is it unique to?
Perhaps that's a question for counsel. If you know,
it is unique.
Counsel, if the national prosecution standards are referenced in other section of election, in other areas of election law.
Well, Madam Chair, in terms of violations of other criminal laws, that's
period.
What I'm trying to get at.
Period. Put it there.
Madam Chair, I don't know, but I can look into
no,
that.
No, don't waste your time.
Mr. Kingrey.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. I said don't waste your time. It does not exist anywhere else in the criminal statutes. No.
Thank you very
much. Correct.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kingrey, I just want to clarify, though, here that in this current law, it says, though, that if you're notified by affidavit, what you're mandated to do is to investigate, not prosecute. That only if there is probable cause for instituting a prosecution, then you shall proceed. But you need probable cause and in any other situation. But it does mandate that you investigate. And I think that's what's really important here, is to recognize that that is what the law currently here says. One of my questions for you is that if this law were to be changed, and I can really understand why you might bristle, I think. I mean, it's kind of a, I think it's hard to say the rest of the, if you fail to do that, you're guilty of a misdemeanor and upon conviction forfeit office. I think that's always a hard thing. I can imagine anybody else professionally would find that hard. But I'm sure at that time it must have been to just emphasize how serious this is, because elections do have consequences and things are decided that are really, really big. My question for you is that in the rest of this bill, there have been some other statutory changes. Do the rest of these statutory changes, because one of the things is that your time. And so the easier that a statute makes it clear on what is happening and makes it specific, it can save you money, because the collection of data, or properly done, just as in any law enforcement case, we all know that a scene of the crime, you might have a situation where evidence could be tampered with, you could have evidence that contaminates or is questionable, but the more clear it is much value to a county attorney when he seeks to prosecute after investigation and seeming to find probable cause. Do the rest of the changes in this bill assist the county attorneys or law enforcement in lifting some of the burdens of enforcement, or are they neutral?
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, with regard to the rest of the provisions in this bill, I'm going to probably answer in kind of a backward sort of way, and I apologize for that. It is not inconsistent with our view in terms of what came out of the governor's task force on election integrity. I believe it does provide the clarity that we would like. I know one of the provisions in there, the affirmative defense for someone that registers to vote and then is notified that you're not supposed to register and then does not vote, that's an affirmative defense if there is any prosecution. That's in there at our request. I know the two individuals that we had on the task force did advance that, and we're very supportive of that. I believe the rest of it, I guess I would be neutral to leaning towards it. It probably does provide some of the clarity that we need.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Madam Chair, again, it seems as though we've taken care of an affirmative defense, but not an affirmative prosecution. In other words, my question is not, have we taken care of someone in a situation, as has been mentioned before, that may be in that? I want to know, in regards to somebody who actually commits a violation in regards to this, are these changes in the law going to help prosecute someone who has violated?
Yes. Senator Champion.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes.
Madam Chair, I would like to hear, because the county attorneys are the ones that I feel have real responsibility here.
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, we believe that it will, that it will provide the clarity that we need. And again, we're supportive of the direction that this bill goes.
Madam Chair, follow-up question.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Kingrey, would you please tell me which sections of the changes that are made here that you would feel would be helpful in that regard and how they would be helpful?
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm not comfortable doing that. I was in my office 20 minutes ago, and I apologize. I was in my office 20 minutes ago working on something completely different. I came over here prepared to talk about the NDAA standards. I am not comfortable at this time. I'm happy to do it, Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer. I'm just not prepared to do that today, and I apologize for that.
And Senator Kiffmeyer,
it's understandable.
I would note that the county attorneys that were represented on the task force, I can't remember who they were off the top, Mr. Kingrey.
It was Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, and before him, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Pat Diamond.
Okay, thank you. That they did sign the report that makes all of the recommendations that led to this legislation.
Madam Chair, I'm glad that they were satisfied, but as a member who has a vote on this bill, I just want to be sure and also make it official on the record because of the other concerns and questions, not just this particular one. So I'm glad to just wait for I appreciate the fact that Mr. Kingrey was called over here on this short notice, and I certainly respect and appreciate that, though this bill is in front of us, and it's, you know, those things. But I'll wait until maybe some other time.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I wasn't trying to cut you off. I was just trying to point out that there were representatives from the County Attorneys Association who signed off and are supportive of the entirety of this bill. Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, what I will do is I will email Mike Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman this afternoon and ask for a response to your question.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as I've got you up there, Mr. Kingrey, a different question entirely that maybe you can help me with. It's been a long time since I've stood in a courtroom and been involved with a sentencing of someone who has been convicted of a crime. But when I was doing it, the way it would work would be a judge would say, Mr. So-and-so, you are hereby sentenced, and the individual would be sentenced to a time in prison. And then the judge could go on and say that, however, execution of the sentence is hereby stayed, and you are placed on probation under the following terms and conditions. And the judge would then outline the various provisions of being on probation. Might be you can't drink anymore, you have to stay away from so-and-so. But there would be a whole list of conditions. And one of those conditions would be, number one, you can't commit any more crimes while you're on probation. And one of the conditions were that your civil rights are hereby suspended and you can't vote. Is that sentencing procedure, when the convicted individual is standing in front of the judge, still being practiced, where the conditions of probation are being explained to the individual who is being sentenced?
Mr. Kingrey.
Madam Chairman, Senator Newman, two things. You initially started talking about a stay of adjudication, which is not a conviction. And we'll just leave that aside for now, and we could have a subsequent discussion on that. With regard to the conditions of probation, I guess I would say it's as individual as the number of judges that we have here in our state. I have to believe that during sentencing, as you have witnessed in the past, the judge does say what are the conditions of your probation. And in there, it does, I assume if it's a felony, they do talk about your civil rights. That information is also provided by the probation officer at a later date. So that is still done, you know, along with a lot of other conditions. And I guess what I would say is regrettably, some of these individuals have forgotten about some of those conditions.
Thank you, Mr. Kingrey. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate File 164? Seeing no one at this time, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 164 as amended be laid over. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? the motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Champion and Mr. Kingrey. Senate File 631, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I on Senate File 631, first of all, thank you for letting me testify and be part of this. I move and am requesting that Senate File 631 be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. With me today, you're going to hear from our elections presenter, Beth Frazier, who is the Director of Government Affairs, as well as Debbie Erickson, who is the Elections Coordinator for Crow Wing County and the co-chair for Elections Committee on the Minnesota Association of County Offices. And I'm going to be real brief on Senate File 631. The bill amends the threshold for election recounts that are paid with public funds. That's the key point. Federal, state, and local offices are covered by this bill. And as we're all aware, the current law requires that a recount automatically be conducted at taxpayer expense by a vote margin is less than half of 1%. In statewide races, that really equates to between approximately 10,000 voters on the non-presidential years and about 15,000 voters on presidential years. One of the things that pops out is recounts for state and federal races are automatic. As you know, they must be conducted unless the losing candidate waives the recount. This differs from local races where local candidates must request that a publicly funded recount be conducted. One of the things we also should take a look at is the making these changes, I believe, and we'll go to Ms. Frazier, but making these changes, we believe, will lead to cost savings for state and local governments. And it gets us on the right track to being good stewards of public funds. So with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I give Beth Frazier.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Senator Hoffman explained, this bill basically does two things. It changes the recount threshold for statewide and congressional races. Currently, that's one half of 1%, and it would reduce it to 0.25% or 3,000 votes, whichever is less. It does not change the threshold for legislative races. That would stay at one half of 1%. And for local level races, it changes the threshold only in cases where 50,000 or more votes are cast. So only in very large local races does it change the threshold, again lowering it to 0.25%. If fewer than 50,000 votes are cast, it keeps the current margins in place. The other thing it does is it requires candidates for state and federal offices to submit a written request for the recount to occur, which would have made a difference. We have had three statewide recounts in recent years, and the first one that didn't get very much attention was in the primary in 2008, and it was for an associate justice position for the Supreme Court. And in that case, the vote margin was it was 0.4%, so it was less than one half of 1%. And our office worked with local election officials to conduct this recount, and no one showed. The candidate did not come to any of the recounts, did not appear to be interested in the recount, but because the candidate did not waive the recount, our office and local election officials were required to conduct the recount. And so this bill would eliminate the requirement that recount be conducted, both because it didn't seem that the candidate was interested. If they had been interested, they could have submitted a request for it, but also because it would have lowered the threshold and it would not have been a publicly funded recount. There was, of course, the recount in 2008 general election for U.S. Senator, and that vote was very close and would still require a recount under this bill. The margin in that case was 0.0075%, and we're talking about changing the threshold to 0.25, so a recount still would have been required in that race. The other recount, statewide recount, that we've conducted in recent years was the general election in 2010 for governor. And in that case, the margin was 0.4%. So it's It was required under current law because it's under 0.5%, but would not have been required if this bill were to have passed. I'd be happy to answer any questions. The one other thing of note is that in 2010, the state did reimburse our office and counties for the costs they incurred in the recount, and in that case, the cost was about $322,000. And so if we could have avoided the gubernatorial recount, there would have been that savings. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman or Ms. Frazier, any idea as to the amount of savings that this bill would give us? And if not, would we be looking at that fiscal note when this goes to the campaign, to the Finance Committee?
Well, Senator Newman, as Ms. Frazier said, it depends on each election moving forward. In the case of the gubernatorial recount, that would not have been required in the last election, saving the state over $300,000. So I don't anticipate there will be a fiscal note, though, attached to this bill in and of itself for that reason.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, there's some anecdotal numbers out there, but not a full study. But what I do know is this. Of the $322,000, that was 8,700 and some votes. It's about $37 per person that was done. By lowering that threshold to a quarter, we could have, avoided those, and the outcome would have been the same. We would have had the governor. I have not seen a complete study, but just the anecdotals. I don't know if, Beth, if you have anything to add to that on numbers.
Well, just because it would be perspective into the future. We don't know how the elections will turn out. I don't think that there would be a fiscal note that's attached to this because of that. The state is obligated under current law, still under this proposal, to pay for costs of recounts, though.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. And I'm, even if we had anecdotal information that would be available to us, it would give us some idea as to whether there would be and the amount of a cost savings to the state of Minnesota if we were to go along with these recommendations.
Then
I do have a follow-up question.
I was just going to say, Ms. Frazier, do you know how much that judicial recount was in the judicial primary, how much that cost?
Madam Chair and members, for the judicial recount, we paid the counties 2 cents per ballot as a partial reimbursement of their costs. It did not fully compensate them for their costs, and in that case, there were about 316,000 ballots, so somebody who's better at math can do the math, 2 cents a ballot. But that did not fully compensate them for the costs. For the 2008 U.S. Senate election, we reimbursed the counties at 3 cents a ballot, and that came nowhere close to covering their costs. The only race for which we have any more complete information is the gubernatorial race, because in that case we did survey the counties, and because when they agreed to participate in the recount, they all agreed before the election, before we knew whether there was going to be a recount, if there's a recount, would you help participate and help us do the recount? And they agreed, and at that time we agreed to pay them 3 cents per ballot, plus we agreed to go to the legislature and ask for a deficiency appropriation to reimburse them for their other costs. And so they filled out a survey and told us how much they spent, and that's how we got the total of $322,000 in that case.
So Ms. Frazier, the 3 cent per ballot or the 2 cent per ballot is not something that is in state statute. That's something that you come up with in agreement with the counties?
Madam Chair and members, yes, that's right. That number is not in state statute. It's what we offered and the counties accepted at the time. I'm not sure in retrospect they would have.
Had we known.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question on a different area on the issue regarding the candidate has to submit a written request in order to have a recount conducted for either Senator Hoffman or perhaps Senate Council. What is the criteria for that written consent? I mean, is there a timeline by which the written consent has to be submitted? First class mail, certified mail.
Into section one, but, Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I think you're referring to section one, where the results, the 48 hours, the submit a written request for to the final. Are you talking about that section, Senator Newman, or
well,
or 2.19? Are you?
Senator Hoffman, I am looking at line 1.19 upon receiving a written request. And I guess I'm sorry, but I'm not seeing the rest of it. What can you help me?
Sure. Counsel, if you could clarify, Senator Hoffman is proposing to add on lines 2.19 and 2.20 a timeline of by which the candidate needs to request the recount. Is there a timeline in the statute now that is called for?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the current statute that we're looking at here, these public funded recounts, it's automatic. Nobody would request. So there is no timeline for filing a request for a recount under the current provision. It's automatic. Under the bill, there would have to be some, if you start looking at line 1.21, the board must notify an individual that qualifies for a recount at public expense. And then the candidate must provide a written request no later than 48 hours that they would like that recount. And there aren't any further parameters on what that must look like, how it's delivered, or those sorts of things.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've done a quick calculation of the last statewide election because of the language here. Is the smaller of 3,000 votes, or 0.25%. And so if I take the smaller of 3,000, in the last statewide governor's election in 2010 that has been referenced, that would be the equivalent of 0.001%, 0.01%. I think dropping down from the current 0.5% to 0.25% is one issue, but choosing 3,000 votes, which in a statewide race using 2.7 million votes cast, and a rough approximation of the votes cast for a statewide race could be more or less to some degree, but nonetheless, still, that's an extremely small percentage of difference. That's kind of the net effect of 3,000 votes or 0.25%, whichever is less, both by the summary and by the statute. So I really express my concern in that regard. And I think going from 0.5% to 0.25% is enough, probably. That's a 50% decrease already.
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, just as a little bit of context, in the last gubernatorial race, 0.5% would have been 10,526 votes. 0.25% would have been 5,263 votes. And the bill would say, or 3,000 votes. In that case, the vote margin changed by 310 votes. In the U.S. Senate recount in 2008, the vote margin, not counting additional absentee ballots added by the court, but just the original ballots cast, the vote margin changed by 264 votes. And in the state Supreme Court race in the primary in 2008, the vote margin changed by 7 votes. So I guess when looking at this, we felt that 3,000 was more than enough of a buffer. But if the committee feels more comfortable with just a 0.25%, that is fine as well, of course.
So it sounds like, Ms. Frazier, if I heard the numbers accurately, the smaller of 3,000 votes or 0.25 in the gubernatorial recount, 0.25 would have been roughly 5,000 votes.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer, would you prefer that we change the 3,000 votes up to 5,000 or just strike 3,000? Or does the committee have any preference? Or Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair, I'm fine if Senator Kiffmeyer if the 3,000 votes leaves a little bit too much ambiguity, I'm open to keeping that as one quarter of one or one, you know, of the 1% of the total number of votes.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Frazier.
In the U.S. Senate race, because it was a presidential election and more people voted, one quarter of 1% would have been 7,200 votes.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think that you put a definitive 3,000. It's that it's so specific. Again, the discussion of going from 0.5% to 0.25%, and the other issue is that this is for both statewide and congressional. There are 8 congressional districts and 1 statewide. So, you know, I think when you go to 0.25%, you're more apt to adjust on principle, whether it's statewide or congressional, and otherwise you have 1 statewide is 8 times larger than a congressional district, but nonetheless you have a fixed, no matter you're saying 0.25%, you still have a fixed 3,000 because you say whichever is less. And when you do that, that means the real amount is 3,000, whether it's statewide or congressional. And I just think that 0.25% is enough of a jump already from the 0.5%. And so disregarding the 3,000 or whatever council says is the way to do it. It's worded a little more complex, so I don't think just the simplicity of delineating 3,000 will maybe do it. General counsel can tell us better.
If I'm understanding the concern, if we simply strike the 3,000, the smaller of 3,000, and leave it as 0.25%, in all sections of the bill that's referenced, would that alleviate your concern, Senator Kiffmeyer? So it would be 0.25% then.
I would say, Madam Chair, that in general, for the ballots that are in the box and having them recounted again, and you're just simply dealing with that, I think it addresses that issue because I think our precinct optical scan have proven to themselves in a variety of ways, as long as we keep the sufficient number of audits in place. And so this is a case where this may take care of this particular one, everything else being the same, but there's another bill that also changes some other parts of election law. So I'd have to take a look at that before I can give. For this particular piece of it, yes. But you're still reducing it from 0.5% to 0.25%, and you're looking at changing our audits, the administrative audits, to just go through it. And so I have 2 concerns in that regard, but this would take care of the one.
Okay. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I make that motion to amend the bill to strike wherever it says 3,000.
Council, if you could please.
For the arguments that have been made.
If you could please offer the suggested language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 1, line 14, strike less than and delete the smaller of 3,000 votes or.
Less.
And on page 2, line 11, delete less than and delete the smaller of 3,000 votes or.
We don't need less than
0.25%. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I was wrong. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'll restate that. On page 1, line 14, delete the smaller of 3,000 votes or, and on page 2, line 11, delete the smaller of 3,000 votes or.
Senator Rest moves that language. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Ms. Erickson, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Debbie Erickson. I'm the elections coordinator for Crow Wing County and speaking today as the co-chair of the Elections Committee for Minnesota Association of County Officers. MACO does support the proposed changes to the recount process. We do feel that the lower margin for a publicly funded recount is justified based on the demonstrated accuracy of our voting systems. As Ms. Frazier just noted, in 2008 and 2010, the changes of what outcome was after Election Day and the recount. Under existing statutes and rules, there is an extensive pre-testing process for all election equipment, as well as a public accuracy test of all equipment that allows any candidate or interested party to observe the process and have comfort that the election equipment accurately counts the votes as they are cast by the voter. Mandatory recounts at the half-percent threshold for statewide races have cost taxpayers significant dollars when the election day results were thousands of votes apart. As was noted in the 2010 gubernatorial election, the statewide cost was $322,000. Ms. Frazier also noted that in 2008, the state reimbursed the counties at 3 cents per ballot. After that election, we calculated our actual cost for probably closer to 15 cents per ballot, and we were reimbursed at 3 cents per ballot. So as she noted, we probably wouldn't go along with the 3 cents per ballot provision again quite so easily. We do believe that it is good policy for the losing candidate to indicate formally that the recount should actually take place, even if it was within that automatic threshold, as was referenced with regard to the 2008 Supreme Court race. We do believe that having the candidate request the recount will prevent expensive recount processes that do not have impact on the election outcome, and in cases of the primary, can slow down the process of getting ballots ready for absentee voting for the general election. MACO supports the intent of the bill to reduce the threshold for triggering recounts, but would recommend a difference of 0.25% for all offices, not just statewide offices or congressional races. In any circumstance, an unsuccessful candidate can always request a recount for any office as long as they are willing to pay for it, no matter what the margin is. We believe the 0.25% margin is the appropriate level. Reducing the threshold for mandatory recounts and requiring the unsuccessful candidate to request the recount still allows for a proven recount process that can be better administered in a more cost-effective manner. Thank you for your time today, and we urge your support of Senate File 631.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 631? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman moves that we lay over Senate File 631 as amended for inclusion in the elections omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Ress, Senate File 661. Senator Ress, Senate File 661.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A1 amendment.
This is the first, the committee of origin for this bill. The A1 amendment does get the bill in the shape that Senator Ress would like. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senate File 661 represents policy changes recommended unanimously by the Campaign Finance Board. And a couple comments about the Campaign Finance Board, just to make sure people know what kind of board they are and how they relate to the legislature. The Campaign Finance Board is made up of 6 members, all of whom are appointed by the governor, and all of whom must be confirmed by a 3/5 vote of both houses of the legislature. This is the one body where the House of Representatives also participates in the confirmation process. 2 of the members must be former legislators. An additional 2 must have no particular partisan background other than perhaps having attended their precinct caucus. And then the other 2 must subscribe one major political party principle and the other to a different party principle. And no more than 3 members may subscribe to the same party principle. So it makes it a board that tries to operate by consensus where it can and where no particular political party has a majority of the votes. Why is that important to know? It is because in these recommendations, they do come before us with
unanimous support of the board and are, again, which is not made up of any particular majority of political party. What I would like to do, Madam Chair, is go through the sections of the bill, and members may either follow with the sections of the bill or look at the sections as they are in the summary that Senate Counsel has prepared, and then at the close of that, to turn to Mr. Goldsmith, who is the Executive Director for the Campaign Finance Board, to go further into their rationale for making these proposals and to answer your questions regarding those rationales.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, I have read the bill, but obviously have not read the A1 amendment. As you are presenting, would you be able to point out to us when you hit an area that is different from
I can do that right now, Mr. Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Newman. First of all, the bill has attached to it as Article 2, Senator Eakin's bill that passed out of this committee, which are technical recommendations coming from the Campaign Finance Board. That's one change. A second change is in the original bill, there were references to data privacy issues. They have been removed here. We'll be taking those up at some other time and perhaps not even this year. Thirdly, there is a section that had been, or not a section, there's a sentence that had been stricken from the statutes regarding the ability of a lieutenant governor candidate to raise funds, and that language has been reinstated. Although it is the practice in most political parties, I believe, for a gubernatorial candidate to select a lieutenant governor candidate and that selection to be upheld in a state convention setting by the convention, there is certainly the possibility still that a person might, or a gubernatorial candidate may say, let the will of the body decide who the lieutenant governor candidate is and not make that kind of choice. And so although that language had been stricken from the text, we reinstated it so that a lieutenant governor candidate could operate for the purposes of that convention to raise and expend funds. Those are the only changes.
Is there another one? That one minor one on the repealer that was inadvertently repealed?
Oh, and then there is a minor change on a repealer. Those are the only changes. But we decided that it would be better because we were adding the Senator Eakin's bill to do it as a delete everything amendment. So, Madam Chair, so Article 1 is the a heart of the recommendations, and at the Section 1 is definitions, and you'll find that there are a lot of definitions that are coming up in this bill as they are making these policy changes. In Section 1, there is a definition of a ballot question political committee, and in 2, a ballot question political fund. In Section 3, that's just a technical change. In Section 4, the definition of contribution is enlarged to make sure that we understand that an allocation by an association, which is already defined, of their general treasury funds, if that is given to if that is used for activities that have to be reported, that it counts as a contributions for the purposes of disclosure that are later required under the bill. Section 5 gives a definition of expressly advocating, and I would call a member's attention to, in the past, in 2010, we had a bill that we sent to, was it 2010 or two? The other bill, the campaign finance bill. Was it 10? In 2010, we had a bill that responded to the Citizens United case and with regard to disclosure, and we tried to follow very closely the directives of Citizens United, but also looking for ways in which we could have some transparency in our statutes with regard to disclosure. So any number of the provisions in this bill take that a step farther, and I think you'll hear from Mr. Goldsmith that they also kept in mind the directives of the Citizens United and also of the court case that Minnesota directly participated in following that. Section 6 defines what general treasury money means. Section 7 defines the word person for the purposes of this statute. Section 8 is a technical change indicating that a political committee can support the nomination or election of more than one candidate. They were never taken to task if they did that. But if they supported multiple candidates, but we're just making sure that the law reflects what the actual practice is and the standard to which they are held. Section 9 also references the same kind of technical correction or clarification, and also because it's commonly called that, the term political fund, is also used in the statutes to refer to an association acting through its political fund. Sections 10 and 11 are technical and intended to be consistent with a change that is proposed in Section 12, where it explicitly, even though they deal with it even now, but it explicitly deals with the authority of the Campaign Finance Board to conduct investigations investigations with regard to Chapters 211B04, 211B12, or 211B15. Most of the time we think of the Campaign Finance Board's jurisdiction to be only applicable to Section 10A. And this, we know that they act and they explore 211B, but this makes explicit the authority that they have to do that. It then attempts to be very narrow and very fair with regard to what kinds of investigations or determinations they have, and I would draw your attention particularly to a number one under paragraph B, that the board, that no action can be taken unless they've made a formal determination after an investigation, and that the dollars that were expended were expended for purposes that are not permitted under 10A or under 211B12. And 211B04, by the way, is the disclaimer. 211B12 is, and I get these mixed up sometimes. 211B12, it deals with legal expenditures, and 211B15 deals with corporate campaign contributions, which as far as individual candidates are concerned or against the law. Also, it puts into place a standard of preponderance of the evidence rather than what currently they go by, which is a probable cause. So it is a higher standard for the board to act. And that is the rest of that section. I would draw your attention to lines 533 through 535, and to point out that no one has ever been prosecuted under 10A in our statutes. Nobody has ever been prosecuted under 10A. Section 13 is a permission for the board to issue the advisory opinions, which they often do, and a lot of times I think, or maybe all the time, it is anonymous, so that no one, the public, does not know who is asking about a particular situation that they want an advance opinion of from the board. Section 14 is the penalty language for issuing a false statement. In another bill, Mr. Goldsmith has indicated what the difference is between something that is knowingly done and something that is done willfully. And that is just maintained in here with a slight change in the language that it has to, you have to know that you're doing know what it is you're actually doing, and that the 7.1 through 7.3 page 7, lines 1 through 3 deals with the investigation as a result of the investigation that was made into the Republican Party's finances a couple years ago with regard to who's responsible, who is to be held responsible when there is incomplete or false information. Then the Section 15 provides for penalties, again, for people who knowingly violate that particular subdivision, and that a knowing violation, and again, separate it from willful, but knowing violation is a gross misdemeanor. Then, shifting gears, Section 16 sets up some of the provisions now for what happens and the circumstances under which a committee is started up, required to register, et cetera. We have grown accustomed to that level being $100, so that whenever someone gives you $100 or whenever you expend $100, then you have to either register with the board, and you also have to start up a committee. This is an attempt to modernize that level to be, you know, really practical and with regard to a committee. And I would, if you have questions about that, I would certainly encourage you to ask Mr. Goldsmith what the rationale for that is when I finish going through the bill. So that level throughout, you'll see a number of times when 100 is stricken and $750 is inserted, and it has to do with the same thing. With regard to independent expenditure committees, however, that level, that threshold, is raised to $1,500 in a calendar year, or if it's a ballot question, that it is has to be more than $5,000 in a calendar year. Section 19 forbids commingling of funds. Section 20 sets out what are the permitted disbursements for either an independent expenditure political committee, and that is the kind of committee that was set up in the law in 2010, or a ballot question political committee or fund which is proposed as a separate entity in this bill. And I would remind us that a candidate can make a statement about a ballot question and just report it as part of their campaign expenditures. A candidate doesn't need to say, you know, vote for this amendment or vote against this amendment. They can just include that in their regular campaign expenditures, and they do not have to separate out or allocate, well, this part, you know, 25% of this expenditure and a piece of campaign material was for a ballot question, and separately state it. We don't need to do that. This is regarding what a independent expenditure committee, again, set up in 2010, or a ballot question political committee or fund, what they are permitted to do. Section 21 goes back to the thresholds for first registration. The Section 22 goes into what the process will be for setting up and the first registration reporting for independent expenditure or ballot question political committees. Section 23 also changes gears a little bit. As you know, right now, if you receive more than $20 in an anonymous contribution and you're not able to determine where that contribution came from, it is your duty to, and your campaign's duty, to forward those dollars to the campaign finance board. And Mr. Goldsmith assures me that it actually does happen. People get these contributions, and they that are over $20, they cannot source them, and they send the money to the campaign finance board. That level is raised here to $50, that's in both Section 23 and 24. Section 25 also references committees that receive contributions that they later within a given period determine need to be returned, and that period when that has to happen is expanded from 60 days to 90 days. Section 26 also speaks to when the circumstances under which a committee needs to file a report. Section 27 sets up the schedule for those reports to be filed. That makes them more, as I understand it at least, and Mr. Goldsmith can go through the actual calendar if you like, to make consistent the timing of the reports that need to be filed among the various committees and candidates. And it sets up throughout these next sections the circumstances under which people don't have to report. When there's been no activity or the only activity is something like getting interest on a bank account or bank charges, the requirements for filing are not as stringent as it is if you are actively raising money and spending money. Also, in Section 28, the threshold by on which items must be itemized on candidates' reports is raised from $100 to $200. So right now, as you know, when you get and I'm relating this to us, but members of the legislature, but it applies to others as well. But if you receive a contribution of over $100, you have to report the name and the employer and so forth. That level here is raised to $250. It's also to $200. Also, the reporting of expenditures, itemized expenditures, happens in the same way. So right now, if a vendor that you purchase something from in the aggregate over the period of the calendar year that exceeds $100, then that's when that vendor needs to be reported and how much you spent with that vendor. And that limit is, or that threshold is also raised to $200. In Section 29, there are again the references to changes that would be made in the pre-election reports, and I think we have, and particularly with paragraph E, to dealing with the applicability to ballot question or independent expenditure political committees and the circumstances under which they would need to report. And then in Section 30, what kind of report when you don't have a committee? Well, once again, we're looking at that spending in the aggregate of either $750 or $1,500 or $5,000, depending on whether it's a ballot expenditure or an independent expenditure, are those different thresholds. In Section 32, also is a policy about when an association is not required to file a statement or report for that particular reporting period if they receive no contributions since the last date that it filed. Right now, we also are, if you haven't done anything and the committee, as I understand it, is inactive, you still have to file a report and say you didn't do anything. And that seems to be redundant, so that if you haven't done anything, if you don't file a report, it's assumed that you haven't done anything. Section 33 then changes to a different issue, and that is the notion of something called electioneering communications. This is a new definition in the law, and it is defined in Subdivision 1 that it particularly and specifically must refer to a clearly identified candidate, that it has to be made during a particular time period, either 30 days before a primary election or a special election, or 60 days before a general election. It has to be targeted to a relevant electorate. That is, in general, I think we would understand that means people who could either vote for or against a particular candidate, that it is made, again, without the expressed or implied consent, authorization, or cooperation, and goes even further, or not in concert with or at the request or suggestion of a candidate or a candidate's principal campaign committee or agent. What I think is more important for the committee to look at is what electioneering communications does not include. And those exclusions begin on page 16, line 21, and includes things like it doesn't include a communication, for example, that refers to an identified candidate who's an incumbent member of the legislature or a constitutional officer that refers to an issue that's before the legislature in the form of an introduced bill. That's not an electioneering communication. And then the in subdivision 2, it further explains what a relevant electorate would be, and then gets to the heart of it, which is if there is an electioneering communication, the circumstances under which it must be disclosed. And then goes on further in there with a lot of language. One of the things that I think is important, just as we have to make a disclaimer statement on lines, page 19, line 19, the electioneering communication must also include a statement of attribution. Section 34 is fairly technical with regard to transferring debts. Section 35, in the end, is part of the repealer of 10A24 and just gives the circumstances and the requirements under which a committee terminates, and then the circumstances under which the assets of the committee are disposed of. Section 36 deals with a voluntary inactive status of political funds, or the board can also impose an inactive status even if a committee has not done that voluntarily. If they haven't heard from them in years, and there's the assumption can be made, and it's a little bit tighter language than that, but assumption can be made by the board that the committee no longer exists, and it can be declared by them. Not only that it's inactive, but they terminate that inactive status, and that's in Section 37. In Section 39, the board has proposed a new way for reporting for both expending and raising dollars by candidates. What we have now, as you know, is we have an annual cycle. And what the board is proposing is that instead of an annual reporting, well, not annual reporting. The annual reporting stays, but the period of time under which money is expended and raised by a candidate will coincide with their election cycle. And so for members of the Senate, for example, there would be, within a 10-year period in between redistricting, there would be three election cycles, 2 4-year cycles and 1 2-year cycle. The election cycle for a member of the House of Representatives is 2 years. For the governor and the constitutional officers, again, is always 4 years. And they are proposing that the way in which we account for raising and expending money is to do it by election cycle. And as I understand part of the rationale for that, and I invite you to question Mr. Goldsmith further, is indeed the presence of independent expenditure committees which have no no such restrictions or parameters of timing, and puts candidates on a more level playing field perhaps in dealing with that. So for the lieutenant governor and the governor running together, the every 4 years, the expenditure limit is $5 million. And this is the this is for those, of course, that accept public financing. Also, the board is recommending that all of the other constitutional officers be considered identical rather than a major minor. And so that level is set at $1.5 million. For a state senator at $120,000, again with an election cycle, and for a state representative, $60,000. So how does that compare to what we currently have? In an election year right now, we have that 68, but I'm just going to say it's 70. We have $70,000 that we can spend on within the rules of campaign financing. If you take the public money, you can spend $70,000 in the election year, and then 20% of that amount in each non-election year. So within the election cycle, that amounts to $70,000 plus 3 times $14,000, which comes up to $112,000. So $120,000, even at that, from the time that these were, is not very much of a stretch beyond just what we are able to do right now. The board is asking us to consider that these recommendations are at the lower end of what they think we should be moving toward in dealing with election cycles rather than single years. I would point out that for members of the House, that is the that $60,000 again is every 2 years, which is less than twice what it would be right now, and perhaps that should be increased. On the other hand, since state senators have 1 2-year election cycle, that would be $84,000, and again, the election cycle amount that's recommended in this bill as a starting place is $112,000. Also in that section, there is over the years there's been a lot of confusion over who is a first-time candidate and who gets to spend and raise more than others, and that is made much more consistent with who would be considered a first-time candidate, and it is a person who's not previously held that office, whose name hasn't been on a primary or general election ballot for that office, and who has not spent $750 or more than that for any other office that includes that territory. So that kind of rationalizes out who really is a true first-time candidate. And I realize, Madam Chair, we're running out of time, but this is, you know, a very important bill from them. But I will speed up here. Section 40, just as a technical correction for purposes of the bill, to referring to an election cycle as opposed to a year, and that comes down to also the board proposing a change in the contribution limits, and again, this is done within a cycle rather than any given year. And I would direct your attention to page 25, starting with line 4, that the limit for governor and lieutenant governor would be increased to $6,000 during the cycle, that current number would be $3,500. $2,000 in the election year, and then $500 in the other years. So similarly, for the other constitutional officers, it would go to $4,000 and, in effect, raising it from $1,600 for state senators, going from $800 to $3,000, and in for state representatives to from $600 to $1,500. Candidates for judicial office are left the same. And Section 45, describes about our own contributions to our own campaigns. Section 46 redefines what a large contributor would be. Section 47 talks about, once again, raising the threshold from $100 to $200, but also then makes a statement about the relationship of contributions from a national party to the state committee. Section 48 adds a ballot question to independent expenditures in terms of the what's prohibited and what is not. In 49, there is a pro rata disclosure requirement that we had not had previously that's being proposed. In Section 50, the affidavit of contributions that we have now, as you know, for senators, it's $3,000 in increments of $50 within the election cycle. What some people have tried to do in the past is to indicate that in-kind contributions can count toward the affidavit of contributions, and that will be explicitly prohibited. It has to be cash. That's basically what that one is trying to get at. And then in 51 are just where complaints have to be dealt with, and 52 is the repealer that I mentioned earlier. It's at the back of the bill is introduced, and then Article 2 is the technical changes.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee, and if we could please have your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As Senator Rest said, this bill represents the unanimous recommendations of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. We currently have two members who were appointed by Governor Pawlenty and four members who were appointed by Governor Dayton, including a former Republican legislator. I won't go through all of the provisions of the bill.
Oh, Senator Rest and Mr. Goldsmith, we have the room until 3 o'clock, so it's my intention to I know members have other places to be, but I would like to try to hear from the other people who have
That's
come
fine.
To testify.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Madam
Thank you,
Chair.
Madam Chair. I just want to limit my discussion to a few sections that are actually policy-oriented. Most of this bill is fairly technical and relates to administration of the statute. But the board felt that a few policy recommendations were in order because of what it's seen in the last election. We saw legislative races costing upwards of $500,000 when you add in independent expenditures and candidate expenditures. So let me just turn to those sections. First of all would be Section 5 of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
It seems as though when we have folks here to testify and we have a shortness of time, I appreciate Mr. Goldsmith's comments, but I'm just wondering out of courtesy to those here to testify if maybe we should have them go first. It's a custom that we've done before in recognizing
Senator Kiffmeyer, it is the Campaign Finance Board's recommendation, and being that Mr. Goldsmith is the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board, I would like to hear from him as to the overall rationale for different sections of the bill.
Madam Chair, that's my preference as well. I certainly want to hear the testimony, but I presented the bill, but I think it's important to know why these provisions are being proposed. And the only people that can really do that and argue for them is the Campaign Finance Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will leave time for testifiers as well. First of all, turning to Section 5, the word expressly advocating appears in our definition of independent expenditure. An independent expenditure is something expressly advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. This has been around for a long time, and the board's position in the past has been that to expressly advocate, you have to use the words vote for, vote against, or similar words. That was an early Supreme Court case that established that standard. Fairly quickly after that, the United States Supreme Court expanded that standard quite a bit. And in Justice Roberts' opinion in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, Justice Roberts said you don't have to use the magic words before disclosure can be required. All you have to have is a communication that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Now, that's not a broad definition. It's actually quite narrow, because what the rule says in this opinion is that if the communication is subject to any other reasonable interpretation but that it is advocating for the election of a candidate, then it's not subject to disclosure. But if there's no other reasonable interpretation, then the communication would be subject to disclosure. And so what Section 5 of the bill would do is Part 1 codifies the existing board position and the old case law that says use these magic words. And then Part 2 incorporates virtually word for word Justice Roberts' opinion as to what the functional equivalent of express advocacy means. And you could also allow for disclosure of that kind of communication. And so what this would do would expand the definition of independent expenditures to include that type of communication. It's important to note, as the court noted, that this doesn't limit the amount or the people who can make these communications. Corporations and groups can make them, and they're unlimited. I think when I talked to this committee before, I gave you some examples of communications, and we see them. They were used in the last election, and the question is, when you see a communication like this one that I passed out before that contrasts two candidates, says one's record is public and everything is great, and says the other one believes he should lie to the constituents, clearly that is out there for no purpose but to influence the election. Do you believe the voters should be informed as to who's publishing that particular communication? The courts have always held that the state has a very important and substantial interest in providing the voters with information about who's trying to influence their votes. And so this would allow us to bring our law into conformity with the current thinking about the First Amendment in this regard.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On this point, Mr. Goldsmith, there's different organizations that get involved in political campaigners, typically noted as a C3 or a C4 organization. Typically, a C4 organization would be more of the advocate or endorser for or against a cause or a candidate, and a C3 organization would be more, let's say, informative, let's say, of vote records, that type of thing. Under current laws, if a C3 is acting properly, would they, if they informed the voters of a specific candidate's voting record, could that be drawn into this definition that C3 could in fact be advocating for a candidate without using the magic words? And does that upend all of the previous definition that we've had before?
Mr. Goldsmith.
I'm Chair, Senator Limmer. I'm always reluctant to address hypotheticals without a piece of paper or communication in front of me. And it wouldn't matter whether it was a C3 or a C4 or just an organization of people who wanted to publish something. The standard would be, when you look at the communication that's in front of you, is there some reasonable interpretation other than that it was to influence for or against a particular candidate? So I can say with generality that if there are voter guides out there that simply, and I think the League of Women Voters probably does one, that, and I think the Bar Association might do one, that just list all the candidates and list what the candidates have to say in a response to a questionnaire, I think it would be difficult to say that that's clearly to influence an election. On the other hand, I can picture versions of that that one might be, conclude have no purpose but to influence an election.
Madam Chair, sometimes the motive to influence a voter isn't necessarily in the message, but who the message is sent to, or in some cases, who they're not sent to. I can think of a situation where an organization congratulated a candidate for their stand on, let's say, an abortion issue. They're congratulating the person on the pro-life vote that they represented in their candidacy. It's just that they sent the postcard to all of the anti-pro-life voters in the district. Now, the message on the card may only be saying a quote of someone or in wishing to inform or compare candidates, but by sending it to the opposite population, that in an effect was a means to fire up the other side to come out and vote against that candidate. So it isn't always just defined by the message. It's defined by the tactic that message is employed by. Could that be an advocacy? Could that be seen as an advocacy in that regard?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's an excellent question. Under the independent expenditure definition, the one we're talking about in Section 5, the courts have said essentially you can't go outside of the four corners of the communication to look at either the communicator's motive or intention or what the recipient might read into it. You can look at whether it's near an election or not. The question you raise is different because under the definition in Section 5, we would have to conclude that that kind of communication could be subject to a different interpretation, namely to thank the legislator. A different section of the bill would reach that sort of communication, and that's the electioneering communication section, which doesn't look at motive or even the language of the communication. It says if you run these kinds of communications 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election and send them to the voters for that candidate, disclosure will be required. Again, there's no prohibition on it. You can do it without limit either as to who does it or how much is spent, but the voters would be entitled to know who is responsible for that communication.
Thank you. Are you finished with your comments, Mr. Goldsmith, or did you want to comment on
this? That brought me to electioneering communications, and I think that's fairly clear. It's a slightly different type of communication because it might not have, obviously, an electoral purpose, but it's run at a specific time directed to the legislature or to the voters. I do want to allow some time for other speakers. I think there will be lots of other questions, and I'll still be available for those. But I think, unless there are other specific questions, I would cede my time to the other speakers.
Thank you. Mr. McGrath, Dan McGrath, is next on the list to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan McGrath again, President of Minnesota Majority. This bill likely will have little to no effect on the operation of Minnesota Majority, but it will affect a large number, I believe, of C4 and C3 nonprofits. And I find the premise of this new definition of election day or of electioneering to be offensive to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution prohibits the enactment of any law which abridges freedom of speech, including freedom of the press, interfering with the right to peaceably assemble, or prohibiting the petition of the government for redress of grievances. Because of the incorporation doctrine, the First Amendment doesn't just place these limits on Congress, but also upon the states. I think it's particularly significant that the First Amendment doesn't hold speech by the press as any higher or more important or more protected than speech by ordinary people or other types of organizations. But by exempting the news media, this bill does. It holds the press up as though their speech is more important and less subject to information about who are the board of directors, who are the financial powers behind the press when they're writing editorials that are designed to influence elections. So my concerns with Senate File 661 primarily focus on Section 33 of the bill in the A1 Amendment, which redefines electioneering communications in a way that will entangle individuals and corporate entities with new regulatory and reporting burdens, which can have a chilling effect on speech, in order for them to engage in that constitutionally protected free speech. I appreciate that Mr. Goldsmith and Senator Rest and others that worked on this bill attempted to address some of my concerns in advance of introducing it. And as I said, it'll have little effect on Minnesota majority, but I'm very concerned about the effect it will have on other individuals and corporate entities. And I could see ways that in the future, and there's certain things that Minnesota majority has done in the past that could be ensnared by this legislation. So it proposes a series of conditions and qualifiers for individuals and organizations to navigate in order to engage in protected free speech. Depending on the time of year, what will be unregulated speech on one day will become regulated the next and ensnare people in onerous registration and reporting requirements just based on, you know, the circumstances of when the election is coming and what time of year it is. I don't think people should be at risk of fines and regulatory requirements for conveying information or expressing their opinion, no matter what external circumstances are in existence at the time. Regulating speech and imposing penalties for failing to jump through all the right hoops will have the effect of stifling speech. The fact that an election is approaching should not be cause for the state to stifle speech. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Andrea Rao is the next person on the list. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I'm the Legislative Director for MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. And I speak on behalf of our more than 70,000 member families. MCCL opposes Senate File 661 because of the chilling effect it would have on MCCL's ability to engage in grassroots advocacy. Issue advocacy groups are private organizations that provide a vehicle for average citizens to effectively participate in the political process by pooling their limited resources to enhance their individual voices. Such organizations participate broadly in our democratic process by advocating issues of public concern, lobbying for legislation, and at times promoting the election of candidates. Issue advocacy groups enhance individual efforts by association. One individual of average means can accomplish little while alone in the public arena, but thousands of average citizens who pool their resources with like-minded individuals can accomplish great things by working together. The right to associate, therefore, is so fundamental to our democratic republic and the ability of average citizens to affect public policy so important that the United States Supreme Court has recognized it as a fundamental right with powerful constitutional protection. With this in mind, MCCL wishes to express its opposition to the egregious overreach in this bill, the reporting requirements related to electioneering communications prior to elections. In truth, MCCL does not have the resources to often engage in large-scale television campaigns, and most of our communications are directed at our members. But we do engage in smaller, community-related education on pro-life issues. Included in such education campaigns are county fair booths and issue education at churches and local community events. At times, we publish ads in newspapers or radio ads. Often, our issue-based education focuses on legislation that may take several years to pass the legislature. Such education does not end on the day a legislative session ends, but continues throughout the year. Based on the legislation before you today, if we merely mention the author of a bill or mention a legislator while describing previous action on a bill, we would be engaging in electioneering communications if we are doing so within the specified time frame. The disclosure requirements in Senate File 661 that would then be required may not be burdensome to wealthy individuals or associations who rely on a handful of large donations. But for a small organization like MCCL, who does not have a large staff, and the vast majority of our donations are small dollar, the burden would be immense. In addition to the strain it would place on the organization, there would also be a chilling effect on our donors to continue to contribute to MCCL if they wish to maintain their own privacy. Either way, this bill would have a significant chilling effect on what should be free speech. Regardless of intent, it seems that the real effect of these burdensome reporting requirements is less to inform the public and more to deter citizens from publicly engaging in the issues of the day. There is much talk of so-called outside interests having too much influence over our elections. However, it is important to note that only individual citizens can vote. The most an outside interest can do is to provide information on candidates and issues. It is then up to the voters to act. In our republic, founded by the people and for the people, the right of the people to speak out on the most critical issues of the day in the political arena through issue advocacy, as well as the right of the people to come together to pool their resources through associations, should not be infringed. We respectfully urge the committee to reject Senate File 661. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Are there any questions? Thank you. The next on the list is Tom Diamond.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Tom Diamond. What my concern is the impacts on the public subsidy program. As you know, the public subsidy program is a program that was put in place because of those who have concerns about the overwhelming nature of large dollars on campaigns. And it tries to provide some level of equity to provide for those who have a base of support but don't have, are not either wealthy individuals or do not have wealthy individuals or corporations that can support them. And what it does is it limits if you ask for the public subsidy, it limits what you can spend on a campaign and what the size of the contributions that can be given or what you can yourself contribute to a campaign. This dramatically alters that program and what I believe significantly undermine the ability of that program to serve its purpose that it is. And when it was talked about that, well, these are minor changes, I would suggest that these are very significant changes with this provision of the program. Take, for example, using the state senate that many of you are familiar with, these are voluntary. You can go and spend whatever money you want. You can put in whatever money you want or take whatever contributions if you don't want the public subsidy. The question is, to qualify for this public subsidy, should you not have reasonable requirements on it? Currently, it's $68,000 is what can be spent on it, $68,100 can be spent on a campaign if you want that public subsidy. That covers a large percentage of the campaigns that are run today. This would raise it up to $120,000. That would cover most Senate campaigns. So why is this different? We're just going to be giving public subsidy to everybody without the limitations. It was stated, well, you could spend $20,000 now every other year, you know, other years, non-election years.
20%.
But in the world I live in, the neighborhoods I live in, people don't spend $20,000 in non-election years for campaigning. And also what it does in this is it changes the kind of contributions. It changes the contributions from $500 to $1,000 that people can give. In the world I live in, people who give $100 or $200, those are significant contributions and difficult for most people to give in a campaign. A $3,000 contribution is a totally different world, and it overwhelms the contributions of the regular citizens. It also changes what the candidate can do. And now the idea that, well, you could do this in other years, well, people don't give those kind of contributions in the off years. Also, you take the limit on the candidates. Candidates are limited to 10 times the contribution limit. So the contribution limit is $500 now. So it's $5,000 that a candidate can self-fund their campaign. This changes it to 10 times the $3,000 limit. So now a self-funding of the campaign can be $30,000. So you can self-fund the campaign with $30,000. You can accept $3,000 contributions. You can spend $120,000, and you could still get a public subsidy. Well, so why not just give the public subsidy to everybody, if that's really the point? What it does is it undermines the principle of the public subsidy program, which is supposed to be giving a leg up to people who are willing to work on a more grassroots-based campaign, small contributions from a wide variety of people and individuals, and not let the large dollars overwhelm these programs. It also impacts the 20% limit on the lobbyists' large contributions, because now it's based on $120,000, not the $68,000. And again, it's in the election year. That's when the money is. So this makes very distinct differences in how these campaigns run. And it, besides the impact on the dollars in the campaigns, I would argue, and experience would tell, that it really changes campaigns. A campaign that's willing to do a grassroots campaign, work on smaller amounts of money, small contributions, relies on volunteers, relies on door knocking, active communication face-to-face with the campaigns. When you start raising these limits up to the $120,000, $3,000 contributions, what that does is it drives the campaigns into paid staff, paid consultants, robocalling, and other electioneering activities, which is different in the makeup. Again, current law allows any of that, but the reason why the subsidy program is to also allow the alternative for people who are willing to and desire to have a grassroots campaign, that they can do it and that there is some assistance to make that happen. This is a very significant change, and I would just hope that you would really consider the impacts on that program if you were to adopt this the way it's presented. Thank you for your time. Take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Next on the list is John Helmberger. As he's approaching the dais, members, I think we're running out of time for adequate discussion. So just so members know, it's my intention that we'll take up Senator Rest's bill on Wednesday. But I did want to give the opportunity to the people who came before us today to testify. So with that, welcome to the committee, Mr. Helmberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name, as you've heard, is John Helmberger. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Minnesota Family Council and Minnesota Family Institute, a 501c4 and 501c3 organizations, respectively. And I'm here on behalf of the approximately 200,000 families that are members of and constituents of our organization. I share the concerns that have already been expressed by Mr. McGrath and Ms. Rao. And we'll not repeat those, but I have a few more that are of equally great concern to us. And foremost of them is that we believe that the provisions of the legislation before you, Senate File 661, would chill, based on the feedback we get from our constituents, it would chill one of the most important functions of any nonprofit organization in with respect to elections, and that is nonpartisan voter education. And this applies both to C4 and C3 communications that relate to nonpartisan voter education, and especially C3. Every election cycle, Minnesota Family Institute, RC3, goes through a rigorous legal review process to prepare a qualified nonpartisan 501c3 voter guide to distribute to member churches of our organization and to print and distribute in bulk to share widely beyond our own mailing list. And based on the feedback that we get every election from our voter guides, whether or not something is capable of any other reasonable interpretation than express advocacy may not be as clear as Mr. Goldsmith has suggested in his remarks, because every time, every year, we have people that suggest that our nonpartisan voter guide is in fact partisan because it makes one party look very different from another party. Well, if there are differences between party platforms, that's going to be reflected in candidates' responses on a wide range of issues, and that's what happens every time. So while something may be purely nonpartisan to one individual, it may not appear that way to another, and so that reasonable interpretation may not always be so clear. Furthermore, we believe that this provision is unnecessary because already, and as we go through and as organizations like ours go through the legal review process for voter education communications, when communication is deemed by legal counsel to constitute express political advocacy, we do it through a registered independent expenditure political fund or committee so that we are meeting those requirements where it's appropriate to do so. Secondly, and as important as the chill on nonpartisan voter education activities is the fact that Section 4, with respect to contributions, Section 33, Subdivision 4, and Section 49, while on the one hand this legislation would chill a nonpartisan voter education, on the other hand, it would actually force speech on people who have not spoken. It would do that by attributing political speech to people who have done nothing of the kind, by requiring disclosure of undesignated contributions to an association's general fund if the association uses its general funds in its nonpartisan voter education communications, which organizations like ours virtually always do. That's how we operate. And so it essentially, this legislation would essentially force speech on people who haven't made speech. And it would communicate a falsehood about individuals who made undesignated contributions to an organization's general fund by disclosing them as contributors to political speech. In addition to that, Subdivision 4, it also appears that in Subdivision 4, churches and other groups could be forced to register and disclose their donors if they acquire and distribute a nonpartisan voter guide from an organization like ours. In another concern not related as much to the electioneering but to the ballot question aspects of this proposed legislation, what this would do is establish in law what the Campaign Finance Board has done in the last 18 months with respect to ballot question activity. And that is to establish reporting requirements for ballot question activity that heretofore have not existed in Minnesota state law or even in the practice of the Campaign Finance Board. And we believe this is completely unnecessary and uncalled for because ballot question campaigns, by definition and by their very nature, are not susceptible to the same risk of corruption that candidate campaigns can be because of the fact that there is no candidate in office after the election for powerful forces to influence. The issue is decided by the voters, and in the course of the campaign for a ballot question, the pros and cons on either side of the question are adequately aired in the public, regardless of who is funding what side of the issue. So we believe that the requirements that are in this legislation, essentially establishing what the Campaign Finance Board has followed for the last 18 months, are completely unnecessary and inappropriate. And finally, with respect to Subdivision 1, Part B, at least that was in the original language that I received. I'm not sure if it's exactly cited that way in the amended version. This provision would revoke the exemption of communications via an organization's website if that website is cited in nonpartisan voter education communications that are distributed by the organization. So it appears that the language that's before you is giving with one hand and taking away with the other. And that concludes my comments, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Helmberger. Seeing that it's 3 o'clock, I know that Mr. Knapp would like to testify, but I also know, Mr. Knapp, that you're around here. And so if it's okay, we will hear your testimony and from anyone else in the audience who cares to testify on Wednesday. So with that, Senator Limmer.
Just before we close today, I noticed that half of our bills today were introduced in the Senate on the 21st. That's 4 days away, 4 days prior to this date. We have a rule that says that we're supposed to have 3 days of notice for the public. 4 days maybe technically does it, but there's 2 days over a weekend that it's not business days. And I'm just wondering, is it your intent to have a fast run on bills of this nature, of this scope, of this total change?
Senator Limmer, this bill we're going to consider again on Wednesday. So I understand that this is a complex and large bill.
It is.
Given that fact, instead of scheduling a hearing for tonight, I thought by moving it till Wednesday, we would give additional time for the public to weigh in. So with that, I'll lay Senate File 661 on the table. Members, I just say that Wednesday afternoon, when we meet again, it's our intention to take up the elections omnibus bill, which members have been emailed a list of the bills that we've heard that is our intention to include in that omnibus bill. Ms. Stengel is preparing the bill right now. When it's ready, we will email it out to the members to look over. It will include bills that we have previously heard in this committee. Members are, of course, welcome to offer or to bring amendments to the hearing on Wednesday, recognizing that we will have a full agenda. We have reserved a room for Wednesday evening as well. So with that, the subcommittee is adjourned.